Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Every field has its jargon, and there's new jargon of the year, the jargon du jour. Well, one of those in the career field, in the workplace field, is on-ramping. It's just basically how to get off to a good start, but we now call it on-ramping. But it is important. You know, you worked your butt off to get that promotion to a cool new job, and you want to make sure you don't screw it up, because, in fact, studies show that almost half of people don't last past 90 days. So when I decided to do a show on this topic, and I did a little Amazon searching and found that the classic book, just recently updated on the subject, is called The First 90 Days, Proven Strategies for Getting Up to Speed Faster and Smarter. And it was written by a Harvard Business School professor, Michael Watkins. And he insists that it applies to both, you know, new managers, higher up people, you know, probably not at the very bottom end, but, you know, our listeners are quite educated, so I figure it would be perfect. But all wisdom does not reside within Michael Watkins, professor of business at Harvard or not. But some of it does reside within a highly successful on-ramper who has done it a few times herself. She hasn't had to job hop very much, but she has also supervised some people who have on-ramped, some really good people. So who better to discuss this with than the Napa County Superintendent of Schools, the member of the state superintendent's cabinet on his technology committee, and the Woman of the Year for her congressional district, and my wife, of course, Dr. Barbara Nemko. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning.
Good. Well, let's start at the beginning. I want to ask you to kind of integrate everything you've learned about on-ramping from your own experience, from, I'll mention his name, Josh Schultz, one of your treasured employees who's on-ramped fairly recently and done a great job, and from this book, The First 90 Days, that you have read. If it was 1 week, you just got hired, and you're starting next Monday, what would you do between now and then?
Well, I would have started before that.
Okay.
Even before you get hired, probably one of the most important things you can do is during the interview, find out what it is that your boss is going to expect of you and make sure that you negotiate that in a way that's going to make sense for you. That is going to depend partly on what the situation is. It's going to be different if you are in, say, a startup company, or if you're in a turnaround company where you have to do something real quick to stop the bleeding. So those sorts of things are different.
Let me build on that. Certainly, in the interview process, it's perfectly great to ask questions like, if I were to be an all-star employee, what would you expect that I would accomplish in the first 30 days? Or you might say, is this job description cast in stone or cast in jello? Is it molded to, can it be molded to fit the strengths of the candidate? And that can start that conversation up front, if it is possible. Sometimes it is absolutely rigidly defined, and sometimes it's not. But that way you get a sense of whether you can try to remold the job description.
True. Although sometimes you can also remold the job description without necessarily even checking with anyone, depending on the extent of your remolding.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, yeah, if you are somebody who's really good at the big picture, but you're not quite as good at all the details, you may want to get someone to, say, your executive assistant, if you have one, or somebody even in your department who's a colleague, you can kind of share it. Some people like big picture thinking. Some people are great at details. Don't do the one that you're not good at.
I remember when you on-ramped as superintendent, your predecessor, he, you know, followed the standard, usually quite good advice to manage by walking around. So he was constantly walking around the office, chatting with people, seeing how they were doing, etc. But you had a different approach, and you let people know that really right up front so that they didn't expect things were going to be the same, but that you had a rationale for doing it differently. Tell us about that.
Well, I had been the director of curriculum, And so I had lots of projects that I was engaged in, lots of things that I wanted to do. I've been in education for decades, and there were things that, for me, were very hands-on. And so I told people that just because I don't pop in every day or every other day to see how you're doing doesn't mean that I'm not interested or don't appreciate it, but you'll probably find me in my office doing a lot of things that I still want to do. So we're all in this together. We have the same goals and the same expectations, but I'm going to do this job a little bit differently than Ed did.
Let's turn to now. So now it's day one on your job, and let's not generalize from you as the superintendent of schools. The
right.
book, the first 90 days, is for people at a fairly wide range of levels, and you have certainly seen some very good employees of yours on ramp well. And you know, I'm just mentioning Josh Schultz because we just talked about him last night. What would be the dream way that somebody, not the king or queen bee number one, but somebody who's in the middle somewhere, what should their first day ideally look like?
I think you want to find out as much as you can about what people have been doing, what the expectations are for your department, your division, what has worked well, and what has not worked well.
How? What do you just walk up to people at random? Do you make appointments? What would Barbara Nemco do? She's not the big poobah now. She's just a middle person in an organization. What would Barbara Nemco do to get that information starting on day one?
I would set up appointments. I would say to people, I would really love to hear what's been going on and see how I can best fit in. Do you have 10 minutes that perhaps one day this week we could get together and chat? That's how I would do it.
Good. How, you know, would you go as far as to invite people for coffee, or let's meet in the great room, go out to lunch, or would that be kind of reserved for something for later when there's more of a relationship?
I would probably want to start with a few minutes and then might make a subsequent appointment, mm-hmm. depending on the chemistry between us, mm-hmm. to meet for coffee or go out to lunch. I want to be careful. Maybe the culture of this workplace is nobody goes out to lunch. Mm-hmm. Maybe everybody has lunch in the break room or somewhere in mm-hmm. the office. Mm-hmm. Maybe they brown bag it. You don't want to be seen as, oh, yeah, she's already throwing around her weight or her money or whatever mm-hmm. by taking me out to lunch.
Mm-hmm. Good. What else would you do on day one?
Well, I would also want to find out as much as I can about the culture, not just what they're doing, but how do people relate here? Is this a really friendly place? Do you do things together as an office? What time do people generally come in? I would be looking around very carefully at how people dress. I think the standard advice is dress for the next position you want to have is good advice. You don't want to come in too casual in a place that is more formal, and you definitely don't want to come in too formal in a place that's casual, but that doesn't mean because everybody else is business casual that you can't dress one level up.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. So, you know, the advice is the first thing you should be doing is, and there's this book by Citrin and Neff, I don't remember the name, where the basic message is listen and learn is one of the most important things you can do early. What other questions, are there any other specific questions? Let's say you've got that 10-minute meeting with various folks in your office. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily, if you're a middle manager, you wouldn't meet with everybody. How do you decide who to meet with, and what other questions would you ask other than tell me about the culture or tell me what's going on here?
What were some of the best ideas that have been tried? And again, this is going to depend on whether you're a startup or you're a turnaround.
Yeah.
If you're in free fall, then you need to find out really quickly, when did the free fall start? What do you think happened? Was there something else that was going on outside? Was there an external threat? Somebody had a better product than we did. So you want to find out everything about how the employees perceived it. You should know that already because you did your homework before you even applied. But you want to get employee perception. Is there something poisonous in the culture that's causing a lot of friction? And has anybody identified that and tried to do anything about it?
Of course, and most people are going to be pretty close to the vest and not share all of that dirt with you right away. I want to take a shot at saying what I would do to try to engender a sense of honesty from folks. I would make a kind of a candid admission about myself that isn't necessarily a strength as a way of kind of opening the door. So I'll say, you know, I'm frankly a little nervous. This is the first time I've been a supervisor, and I want to do it right, but I'm a little nervous. Is there, you know, some workplaces are really healthy and others are a little dysfunctional. What should I know? So by prefacing the request for them to make a revelation about the culture or even themselves, I'm making a revelation about myself, an emotion-based one like that. I'm a little nervous. Do you agree with that?
I'd have to feel that out. Depends who I'm talking to. You know, there's such subtle chemistry when two people talk to each other that it's not always something that you can decide in advance. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I think is important to do if you're now supervising people is to let them know that you're not, unless you're in a turnaround, you're not coming in immediately to shake things up and change things, because people are very nervous when they get a new supervisor, and they fear for their own security, and you don't want to set people up to be nervous, anxious, and hate you before you've even started.
But doesn't that run counter to the convention with that when you're a new employee, you have the honeymoon period, you know, and they're expecting you to, you know, make some changes both in procedures and sometimes in people. If you let that honeymoon period go, won't it be a lot harder later to make those changes?
Not unless you're, I keep saying the caveat, if you're in a turnaround situation where there's bleeding going on, yes, you're going to have to do some things fairly quickly. But if you're in an organization that's moving along fine and you want to get them, say, from good to great, what you don't want to do is make people crazy in the very beginning. Because then they resist you. Then you're in an adversarial position. I've seen that happen. And one of the things that the book talks about, which I thought was wonderful, and I'd never heard it phrased quite this way, was take a mental break from your old job. Do not assume that what made you successful in your old job is necessarily what's going to make you successful in this job.
Makes good. So make that specific. So if, let's say, I was a low-level manager in Company A. Now, and you know, we've been talking to private sector specific. Many of the listeners here at KLW are not exactly big fans of the private sector and are more likely to be employed or look for work in the nonprofit sector or the government sector. So what might be an appropriate thing to, you know, to say and do in that sector?
Would that be any different? Well, remember that I've spent most of my life in the government sector,
right.
So I'm very well aware of what that culture is like. And if you come in and maybe you were a powerhouse where you were before and very aggressive and assertive, and you're very smart, you have some great ideas, and you come in and you start throwing all this at people, I promise you they're going to put up their hands like the devil is coming, because they don't know you, they don't trust you, and all they can see is they're not valued, their ideas aren't important to you. What you want to do is develop a sense of trust and collegiality and share with them what you're hoping to achieve and try to draw out some of the solutions and the changes from them rather than imposing
right.
them from top down.
So implicit in that is, of course, in the public sector, it is often much more difficult to replace a person. A person is generally, those people who are there are going to be there, a large percentage of them. And so you must operate under the assumption that they're going to be there, and therefore, yes, making them feel comfortable and that you're not adversarial is particularly important, and a more collaborative approach to change is critical, is what you're saying.
Well, from an interpersonal sense, wouldn't you rather work with people who are getting along than with a bunch of people who are sending daggers
Maybe.
To you as you walk down the hall?
Maybe. You know, I've seen both work. You know, some of the bosses who get the most done through a combination of inspiring through positive, you know, carrots and sticks, fear and inspiration. And the person who's too nice, yes, leads a very comfortable, happy office, but doesn't necessarily improve things a whole lot. Do you not agree with that?
I think that may be a public-private sector difference, because as you well stated, in the public sector, it's a long, laborious, and very expensive process to move an employee out. Typically, they're in a protected category because I think 40 is where it starts, a protected category.
And there's so, many other protected categories, too. They're now, you know, there's now a move to make obesity a protected category. I don't know if you know that. But the Americans with Disabilities Act, you know, it's, you know, physical, you know, if you have a physical illness or a mental illness or you're a person of color or you're a woman, almost everybody except straight white males who are healthy under 40 are a protected class.
So, you know, the handwriting is on the wall. These are the employees you're going to have. Do you think you're going to get a better work product from them if they hate you and don't want to do anything that you want them to do, or if you can inspire them to see what you're trying to have happen and that you reward them for improving?
This little side path that we just took on was actually in response to a statement you said that one of the things you liked best in the book, by the way, is The First 90 Days, Proven Strategies for Getting Up to Speed Faster and Smarter by Harvard Business School Professor Michael Watkins. And you said that one of the things you liked best in that book was, he said, take a break from the previous skills and that you used in the in your past job, because this is going to be different. Can you give an example of a clearer example of what that's about, what you're talking about there?
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought I did. I know someone who came into a job and was filled with excellent ideas for changing it and just went around and told everybody what they were going to do differently and how the whole organization was going to be different. And that person is now gone.
Right.
2 years out.
But it's not a different skill. I'm somehow viewing that's that speed issue. I'm talking about when you say take a break from what skills you used before, you know, are you really meaning just take a break from, you know, trying to get it done and instead being slower and more collaborative and, you know, inclusive and team building?
Take a break from I have all the right answers to I want to hear what you're doing and what you've tried and how it's working, and let's see if we can make it better together.
Yeah. I also think that it's also an opportunity in a more hard skill sense. I guess that's where I thought you were going. That's why I kept pushing for an answer, a different answer. If I'm, let's say, for example, I was at Company A, and what was really required is my understanding supply chain, because that was their big weakness, and they were spending too much on supply chain, or it was inefficient, or they were abusing the workers in Thailand, or whatever it was, and I focused there. And that's been my big skill set. I'm feeling really confident in my ability to analyze supply chain. But in my new workplace, you know, maybe that isn't so critical. Rather than falling back on that skill that I had honed, take the risk of saying, okay, what is the skill I really need to develop now to be a rock star in this new job? That's kind of the thing that I was thinking we're talking about.
Right. It may be the issue in this company is customer service.
Yeah.
And maybe it's a different issue. Maybe it's not cutting the budget. It's trying to make sure that you're getting product to people faster. It just depends on where you are, and you're not going to really understand that unless you've spent a lot of time finding out.
Speaking of customer service, I think we would serve our customers, who are our listeners, better if we gave them a chance to weigh in on this discussion. So you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. We're talking about on-ramping. That is the first 90 days. You're getting hired, and you want to make sure you get off to a good start. What kind of things can you do? So if you or someone you love is either just been hired in that first 90 days, or you're a supervisor of somebody who's in their first 90 days and you want to facilitate their doing a better job of on-ramping, or if you're unemployed and want to simply be prepared ahead and figure out what you should be doing in your specific case, those are all good reasons to call Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And
another thing that the book talks about is really understanding your boss. You need to know what kind of person this is. Is this somebody who likes to get together on a regular basis? Is this somebody who wants to be communicated with by email? Is it someone who is welcoming if you just show up in the office? And negotiate with that person, make it real clear if that's how they want to be communicated with, that's what you're going to do. And to focus when you meet with the boss primarily on what are your goals and what results have you gotten. And he talks about a 90-day plan when you first start, which is kind of three blocks of 30 days. So in the first 30 days, what you want to do is diagnose the situation, what are the key priorities, and develop a plan for the next 30 days. Then the second 30 days is trying to achieve some early wins, and then in the next 30 days after that, to assess what kind of progress you've made and have a plan for what you're going to do next.
Only a professor could be that structured. Nothing could be that structured. 90 days, 30 days, this, 30. That's not real. But the idea is certainly that you want to listen and learn in the beginning. Try to come up with something that your boss would like to see you do as either a big win, or if you're not that high level, you know, what would he simply or she like to see accomplished? And then, yes, evaluate and reorient. But, you know, these professors with their nice little nifty models that don't fit the real world make me cringe. Am I being too critical?
Well, no, because as I told you after I finished reading it, it was hard for me to read something quite that academic about something that is in so many ways so interpersonal. And, yeah, he's got all kinds of real specifics and charts and check this off and do all that. And I said to you, I could never do that. I could never operate like that. But the basic premises make sense.
Yeah. There are certain small percentage of people who live and breathe for even, you know, a 90-day checklist. And checklists, there was a great book by Atul Gawande about checklists, about the power of checklists. So for me, it's I think maybe it really is more situational. Having a checklist, let me challenge you. If you had to have not some mammoth long 30-item checklist, but if you were to create a checklist, it could be 3 items, 5 items, 10 items. If you were to create a checklist of what would go on your list for what to do in the first 90 days, what would go on your checklist?
Analyze what's going on. Determine the culture of the workplace. Talk with everybody. Find out what the problems are. Who's on the bus that maybe needs to be moved around, since I probably can't get them off the bus? What's missing? Who might we need to hire, or what particular skill might we need to hire? Is that something that somebody here could get some additional training and might be able to do, which would be the best kind of win to promote from within? Those would be the first things that I would put on.
I think the only thing I would add to that would be those are all kind of Let me just add, you know, work hard but not too hard. There's such a natural tendency when you're starting out that you really want to make great impressions so that you work 60, 70 hours a week. I would probably, maybe while I was home, I might do some more studying to get up to speed on some new skill, or what the company's products or services are better, or the competition, or, you know, whatever the landscape is. But I probably wouldn't in the workplace work much longer than I plan to. So that, number one, I know in many workplaces, except for the highest performing workplaces, if you stand out as working too hard, you're not praised for it. Your fellow coworkers will try to sabotage you and smash you down. So I would probably work just maybe if the normal workplace expectation in that office was 45 hours a week, maybe the first couple of weeks I'd work 50, but that's it. And then do my any additional learning or whatever I want to do quietly, privately. So that's what I would do. Just work a little. That was something I would put on my checklist. Work just a little longer than the normative expectation at that workplace, and do any other learning quietly, privately at home. Make sense?
I totally agree with that, because if you come in and most people work 45 hours and you're working 65, they're not going to like that. That's going to be very threatening.
And of course, but that's...
And word gets around.
I'm going to be really honest. To me, that's the sign of let's just say, not a first-class workplace. There are, unfortunately, most workplaces are those where they would denigrate the 65-hour worker rather than praising him or her. And that is a sad state of affairs, because really, the most successful people and businesses, they do not genuflect at the altar of work-life balance all the time. They really don't. The A players are excited, vibrant, content, happy, and because everybody is working, they're not always thinking about their kid's soccer game, getting home in time for their kid's soccer game. That's just true.
But there are plenty of people who are A players who are also concerned with getting home for their kid's soccer game. My brother being a perfect example.
Okay.
He's been a star his whole career, but he's always maintained his work-life balance and always built in time so he could coach the kids' soccer team.
Very good. All right. I'm going to give out the phone number one more time. If anybody listening here is interested in making a comment or a question about on-ramping the first 90 days, if you or someone you love could use some help in getting off to a good start in the new job, or if you are supervising somebody who's maybe not getting off to a great start and you would like some guidance on how to help them, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Is there anything more that you would like to say before we leave this topic? I'm not going to let you go so quickly, by the way, Barbara, as we were talking about, because I got something in store. Anything else? No, we're not nailing you to a cross. Don't worry. Is there anything else that you want to say that you think our listeners need to hear about on-ramping?
Yeah, it's very important with your boss. Bosses rarely like to be surprised about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So if you detect an emerging problem that maybe has not come to the surface, you want to let the boss know that right away.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you don't want all your conversations with your boss to be about problems.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't want to come in and go through your whole checklist and say, I did this, I did this, I did this, I did this, because he or she is not going to like that either. So you want to let him know about what the emerging problems are and bring with you some tentative solutions. Mm-hmm. Never give someone a problem without an idea of how to fix it.
That's true, not only in the first 90 days, but the first 90 years. Anyway, we do have callers on the line. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. What is on your mind? It is your turn.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you have some specific advice beyond what's already been said about if you're coming in those first 90 days and you're supervising someone mm-hmm. who has been there for some time.
Right.
So you're the new person, and then, you know, you have authority and responsibility for someone who's, you know, probably performing at like a B or B-plus level.
Mm-hmm. And so, Barbara, you want to say you want me to take it?
Well, I think one of the things you want to do is give them an idea of what you're expecting and try through developing this relationship to get them to commit to trying to do it and then hold them responsible for achieving it. But when they step up a little bit, you want to recognize that, because if what you want from them is always a step beyond what they're doing, eventually they're going to be burned out and not motivated. If, however, they do a small improvement, you want to note that, recognize it, and then motivate them to get to the next level.
I'd like to get some more specifics. Could you describe, you say that person is likely a B player who's got a lot of longevity there, and you would clearly like to move them up to a B plus or an A minus player. Can you describe what it is you would like them to do that they're currently not doing, or is it too early to know that yet?
You know, it's a little too early, and I'm reflecting on my past experience and thinking about the present, because I had an experience of coming in as a new supervisor to a couple of people that had been in place for 10 years,
mm-hmm.
And sort of they weren't necessarily functioning as a team, and part of my task was build sort of a team spirit, a team effort, and because they were so entrenched in these other patterns that were working quite well in some ways, not according to my vision, but according to what many people in the organization have come to expect, it was a difficult challenge.
Be specific. What occurred in that previous? What were they doing? How were they? Workers, and I'm very familiar with this, groups of workers who make things pretty comfortable for themselves, and they're all supportive of each other, working just that kind of right amount, not too stressful, not too much, and then they resist external stuff. But what was going on in the work group you were thinking of, or is it something, can you be specific?
Well, yeah, I mean, they were very dedicated and very talented. It's just that shifting their priorities or shifting their orientation to working as a team was I think nearly impossible.
Most people hate teams. We're required to say we like teams, but we really hate it, because what ends up happening is some people do more work than others. Not everybody is equal, and there's all kinds of resentment. You know, and you end up losing the sense of individual. You get motivated because you feel you're making contribution. If your contribution is merely from the team, you feel like, well, you know, it demotivates. Why the, you know, it is. your past experience, which is so common, trying to get people to work as a team, you know, ends up not being the most fruitful use of a manager's time. Are you convinced that that really is so primary? I know we hear it in business school. I know we hear it in the media. But in the real world, team is a dirty word, actually. People roll their eyes at the word team.
It's a great question. I've been reading Susan Cain's book about the power of introverts. I'm just coming to a more thorough understanding of how introverts think. And it's been really enlightening. So I think coming into my new job, I'm gonna really have to maybe look at each person more as an individual, like almost in a more sophisticated Myers-Briggs sort of scenario, and try to understand what, you know, where team is useful and where team is like just sapping energy from good people.
Right, that's closer. First of all, the Myers-Briggs, the validity data on the Myers-Briggs is nightmarish. And I'm aware that very prestigious companies, including Bridgewater, which is the largest hedge fund in the world, uses it. But the predictive validity of it is terrible. But I love your idea of treating everybody differently. There are some people who flower as best in a team. There are others who are introverts who are better as individuals. And there are also extroverts who are better as individuals, who are, they're just dynamic, smart people who get dragged down by the team. Everybody is different. I do encourage you to treat not everybody equally, but fairly, so that you maximize. The great manager, the great leader, helps each person to flower, not treating everybody the same. Now, back to your new supervisee who's been the B player. What I would do if I were meeting with him or her is I would start by making them not scared. I want them to feel comfortable. I would say, I am new at this, and you have a lot of institutional history, and that is invaluable. Tell me what I should know about working here, and tell me about you. My job as your manager is to help you flower, to help all of my employees flower, to be their best selves. What can I do to make you an A, to create the circumstances under which you can be an A player? Do you think that that would be a good way to start your conversation with him or her?
I do. It's nice and transparent.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that. Yeah.
Okay. It is amazing how in so many workplaces transparency is not allowed. You know, if you're too direct, you're seen as arrogant, too willful, there is this certain cultures in certain workplaces, and I have a client who's a lawyer in D.C., works in a government with 20 other lawyers, and if you're too direct, you're seen as too arrogant, too willful, not a team player. They want you to be indirect. All this subtlety, all this subterfuge is part of the drama of that work group. Is that something that you've experienced, and is that something, you know, since you appreciated this being quite a transparent approach that I'm offering, have you had an experience in the workplace where it is all this indirectness and all these this drama becomes core to the workplace?
Definitely. And I've tended to work in the nonprofit sector, and I've I think a lot of people get there's a de-emphasis on the specific skills it takes to be a good manager, because people rise for other reasons, for their vision or their commitment, or I've often felt like I wish there were more models for what just pragmatic approaches to managing well look like, more mentoring in that sense. And so the transparency piece it sounds so simple, you know, but I do feel like it's definitely uncommon. It's sort of undervalued.
It was just about a week or two ago, I devoted a lot of the show to the art of management, but to briefly summarize, the great manager just does a few things. First of all, make sure that the right people are on the bus to the extent he can or she can, and replaces people who are not in the right job and does it crisply. The great manager inspires, no matter how low level the job, all ethical work is worthy work, and making sure that everybody knows it and you really believe it in your heart of hearts. You do, as we say, you do not treat everybody the same. You treat everybody as though you are a gardener and you have many different plants. You don't give them all the same amount of sun or the same amount of fertilizer or the same amount of water. You treat each individually to make each grow the most. You have different, for example, sets of accountability. Some people need a lot of close supervision. decision. They need accountability metrics. Others, it just makes them crazy and that just disempowers them. It is the matter. And then when there is bad behavior, you must stay calm. America, especially here in California, is not. Anger is unacceptable. You are comfortable enough in your own skin and what you want done that you give brief amounts of feedback. And if the person is no good, you quietly try to counsel. Don't start the firing procedure legally, because that's going to very often create so much antipathy in lawsuits. You try to counsel that person into finding a better position. That's the world's shortest course in management. To what extent does that feel of value to you?
It's quite valuable. Thank you for that synopsis. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Thank both of you for sharing your wisdom. It has been helpful.
Great. Barbara, is there anything else you want to add?
Nope. I think you said that really well.
Okay. Thank you very much for the call.
I like the analogy in your garden, that you don't give everybody exactly the same thing.
Exactly.
For very good reasons.
Good. Okay. Let's go phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. We're talking on ramping. What is your question or comment for us?
Yes, my name is Robert, and I'm a 51-year-old male, and I'm interested in getting back into the workplace. I've been working for the nonprofit sector for the past 5 years in volunteer positions, mm-hmm. and I've left a few of them feeling underutilized mm-hmm. and underappreciated, and I want to move into a position to start a career where I can actually start making money. And I've actually had problems working for other people before. I've been fired from a lot of jobs, over people talking behind my back and making sexual innuendos. And I've got a 130 IQ, and I see the bigger picture really well.
Okay.
And I don't want to go in thinking I'm smarter than anybody else or anything like that. I just want to go in and perform and do the best I can to show them that I am a valuable employee, and have it stick instead of not get stabbed in the back.
Okay, delighted that you called. First of all, I'm going to disagree with one thing that you said. I want you to feel smarter than other people. We tend to denigrate IQ, but I'm not asking you to be boastful. I'm not asking you to be a steamroller. But I am asking you to quietly realize that 130 IQ means that you have the ability to learn quickly, reason well, be that big, good, big picture thinker. I want you to own that proudly, quietly, first of all. Secondly, when you say you've had trouble working with other people, you said they made sexual innuendos. Are you a sexual minority of some sort and therefore is a subject to that? What kind of sexual innuendos, and why do you think they're doing that?
I was probably years ago working in a restaurant, and the Mexican employees calling me a puto, and rather than responding to it, I just, ignored it.
Well, why? There are gay people. A puto is a whore, a male whore in Spanish. There are certainly many gay employees who would not necessarily have been denigrated. Was it simply homophobia, or was there something, was that a symptom of the fact that they didn't like something else about you? If I had those, and forget about whether they're Mexican or not, if I had this group of all the people, you said you've been fired many times, if I had all the people who has ever worked with you together, what would the consensus be about your strengths and your weaknesses?
Well, I would say that I'm really good at problem solving and customer service, and that I can calm down a situation that escalates really well.
Mm-hmm.
I can also see problems down the road that may come up as a result of what's going on
okay.
now.
What would they say is your weakness? What would be the consensus agreement about what your one or two most significant weaknesses are?
Probably being a slow typist or something, to deal with a little machine work.
That doesn't make sense. That doesn't quite make sense, because if you were a slow typer, you wouldn't just be looking for typing jobs. I would bet that there were some things they don't like about you beyond that.
You know, I've been working on personal issues for a lot of years.
Like? What issues would they say? I'm asking, we've got the 20 people who knew you best in the workplace. What are the personal issues they would say is this guy's weakness or weaknesses?
You know, 10 years ago, it probably would have been drinking. But, you know, I haven't done that for over 5 years.
Okay, great. What else?
And maybe it's... It's hard for me to pinpoint. Maybe I'm very selective about who I spend my time with.
Here you're 100. There are very few 130 IQ guys who are working in, you know, sounds like kind of basic restaurant level work. Is it possible, really, that that you've been beaten down because of your drinking problem and other things over your life, and that you've been hanging around you aren't hanging around with enough 130 IQ people? What if I said you need to aspire upward? Would you say that's delusional career counseling talk, or would you say that's right?
I would say that's probably right on the point.
Okay, good. So now let's figure out what the hell you should be doing. Now, at 51, the world is not very eager to give a really interesting brain-centric job to a 51-year-old guy who's had a checkered work history. So what if I said you got to be self-employed? Would you agree or disagree?
I have, you know, the most successful employment I've had has been self-employment.
Okay, great. So let's go there for purpose of this little conversation. Now, I found it interesting when you said you felt you were underutilized as a volunteer in these nonprofits. So as an attempt to try to figure out what you should be doing in your self-employment, I want to play this little game with you. If I were the executive director of said nonprofit and I said to you, what's your first name, by the way?
Robert.
Robert, if I said that, my job is, as I said to the previous call, is to make you flower. I want to bring out the very best in you, and I will give you any job in my organization you want as long as it is you do a great job and help you flower. What would you want to do for me in my nonprofit?
I would probably go for fundraising.
Great. Okay, great. And there are different kind of fundraising jobs. There are the guys who direct pitchers who meet with the fat cat corporations and fat cat people and pitch them. There are others who work behind the scenes and, you know, do the record keeping. There are others who create events and event planners. What role in fundraising would help Robert flower the most?
I would love to call any corporation that has a dollar to donate and meet with the people to get with them on their next year's budget and see if we can't fit something into their budget that can include our organization and make it a mutually beneficial kind of an agreement.
Awesome. What kind of nonprofits are you most motivated to do that for?
I've been working. Right now I work for the Housing Rights Committee of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
I also volunteer for the district attorney in the neighborhood courts.
Okay. But I'm not interested in tying yourself to your past. If I gave you $1 million and I said that you had to donate it to one or two nonprofits, which one or two nonprofits would you donate it to?
I would probably donate it to something like Mercy Housing, but not like Mercy Housing. I would use it to create housing where we haven't been since the 70s.
Great, dude. So now, what if I said, you know, a big nonprofit's not going to hire you. You have no track record. But what if I said I want you to get off the phone and go on the internet and use that 130 IQ of yours to unearth all the small nonprofits that are related to housing that are simpatico with, when you say you like the 70s, what do you mean? Are you talking about co-housing and collaborative housing and group homes and that stuff? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I'm talking about affordable housing for people who are working for minimum wage and who can't afford to live.
Okay, great. So if I said I want you to get off the phone and go to websites like catalyst.org or GuideStar.org or just Google Bay Area nonprofits and then look one after another and find small housing-related or other exciting nonprofits to you and then go in and pitch, show, demonstrate, show your stuff. Go either make a little YouTube video of you doing a model pitch about how you would go about trying to convince a corporation to donate to a Mercy Housing-like entity, and use that as your calling card and see if you can get people to talk with you and get you a job doing that. So I've now moved away from the self-employment because you've just created a pretty viable kind of a job. Nonprofits love fundraisers. What do you think about doing that?
I think it would be great if I, you know, if it's a good team to work with, and they're doing dynamic work, and I respect their organization.
Okay, would be is nice, and I don't want you to have too high standards yet. You're right now, we're trying to get you a paid job. You've been unemployed a while. I want you to have, you know, yes, go for the best ones you can, but if the first organization you're a fundraiser for is not, you know, doesn't get an A grade, it gets a B minus, do a job there. Use that to get something on your resume and improve your fundraising skills, and then maybe you can move later. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Now, I have one question. I have 6 years ago, I was, you know, I have something on my record that will show up on my background check. Mm-hmm. And this has come up and prevented me from getting, I can't even drive a car with a mustache on it.
What is it? Tell me what did you have?
I was pulled over for singing Christmas carols in Newport Beach and had a tenth of a gram of meth on me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And though I've gone through the expungement process for my complete record, Orange County was unwilling to budge.
Fine.
And I need to go through.
You know what? There are ex-felons who get jobs who have much worse things. So my way is radical honesty. It would be the thing I would lead with. I wouldn't bring it up later, because then it's aha, or let them discover it. I would say, I would start in my, maybe even in my YouTube video or in my cover letter. I would say, you're probably going to be tempted to throw away my application because you're going to hear that I had a tenth of a gram of meth 5 years ago, whatever it was, in Orange County. I'm hoping you'll at least read a little further and then tell your story and why you'd be a good fundraiser and why you're willing to start from the bottom and you've been clean and sober for 5 years or whatever. The wrong employers will absolutely press delete. The right employers will be happy to talk with you because, you know what, especially in the nonprofit sector, there's a hell of a lot of people who have, you know, who have not exactly been Mother Teresa and have been saints themselves.
Right.
So, dude, you know, don't let this be a scarlet A that makes you feel embarrassed and guilt-ridden and stay at home. I want you to mention it up front, and that way you get it out of the way fast. Does that make sense?
That makes great sense.
Okay, Barbara Nemco, you've been listening patiently to all this. You have anything
to
add?
I'm so impressed. I thought you did a great job.
Oh, you're too kind. All right, thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate
Thank
it. Do me a favor. Hey, dude, Robert, I want you to call back. I want you to do this. I want you to get off your ass, and I want you to make these calls, and I want you to do it now. And next Sunday, you are to call back, or I'll break your face. And you're going to tell me what progress you've made. Is that all right?
All right. And your name and number again?
I'm Marty Nemco. This is Work with Marty Nemco here on KALW, 415-841-4134. We're Sundays, 11 to noon.
11 to noon, Sundays.
All right.
Okay.
Be well.
All right, Marty. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Barb, I wanted, you know, I'm tempted. There's so many things I could do. Like, now we have callers and they want to talk to us. I feel like I'm not making the most of you.
Don't worry about me.
I worry about you. You're my wife. I love
you.
And I also
very much. I'm fine. The callers are the ones who need you.
Okay.
Let's take more callers.
Yeah. You know what? Here's what I want to do. The callers have suddenly evaporated because I don't know what happened. But in any case, I want to keep you on. There is an article that has gone absolutely viral on the internet. It has gotten 3,114,000 views as of last week.
Wow, and I'm not one of them. I feel terrible.
Yeah. It's called 20 Things That 20-Year-Olds Don't Get. And I wanted to run these by you.
Yeah, okay.
And tell me, and just get your reactions. I'm going to read the little introduction. It's written by Jason Nazar. And it started like this. I made the cover of one of those magazines of top 20 under 20 lists, and today I employ an amazing group of 20-somethings. call me a curmudgeon, but at 34, how I came up seems so different from what this millennial generation expects. I made a lot of mistakes along the way, and I see this generation making their own. In response, here are my 20 things that 20-year-olds don't get. Number one, time is not a limitless commodity. I so rarely find young professionals that have compelling drive to get to the next level. In our 20s, we think we have all time in the world to figure it out and get what we want. Dude, time is the only treasure we start out with in abundance, and we can never get it back. Make the most of the opportunities you have today, because there will be a time when you will have no more of it. I'm going to keep reading these until you have a comment. You can feel free to interject at any point, okay?
Well, okay, right there.
Yeah.
I think that's true. When you're 20, you think you're going to live forever and you're never going to get old. And I don't think there's any way to change that, because that's just how it feels. But I think that opportunities continue. I don't think until you get to the point where you really can't function anymore because you're old enough or you're sick, there are opportunities every day, new opportunities, and you just have to stay on top of things and be willing when that door is available to run through it.
It's easier, though, when you're 20. There is a lot, especially here in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley, it's a youth culture. And if you haven't started to make your mark in your 20s, it gets a lot harder. Let's go to the next one. The next one of these 20 things 20-year-olds don't get, he says, you're talented, but talent's overrated. Congratulations. You may be the most capable, creative, knowledgeable, multitasking generation yet, but unrefined raw materials, no matter how valuable, are simply wasted potential. There is no prize for talent, just results. Even the most simply, seemingly gifted people methodically and painfully work their way to success. Your reaction?
Yeah, I agree with that.
All right. Next one. We're more productive in the morning. During my first 2 years at DocStock, which is one of the companies he started when he was in his 20s, I prided myself on staying in the office till 3 in the morning on a regular basis. I thought I got so much work done. But now I'm realizing that most of that work done was kind of the menial stuff. It's fine to stay up late, but I start in my current companies, I have an office-wide early start time because I know for the most part we get our best work done early in the day. Any reactions?
Oh, I think that's very personal.
Okay. Next one. Social media is not a career. These job titles won't exist in 5 years. Social media is simply a function of marketing. It helps support branding, ROI, or both. Social media is a means to get more awareness, more users, more revenue. It's not an end in itself. I'd strongly caution against pegging your career trajectory to a social media job.
Unless you're learning enough technology skills that you'll be able to transfer them to whatever your next job will be.
Maybe. Okay, pick up the phone. Stop hiding behind your computer. Business gets done on the phone and in person. It should be your first instinct, not last, to talk to a real person and to source business opportunities. And when the internet goes down, stop looking so befuddled and don't ask to go home. Don't be a wimp. Pick up the phone.
I love the phone.
Okay, next. Be the first in and the last to leave. I give this advice to everybody starting a new job or still in formative stages of their career. You have more ground to make up than everyone else around you, and you do have something to prove. There's only one surefire way to get ahead, and that's to work harder than all your peers. Does this not feel too conservative and flagellating people? Making people work harder, be the first to work, you know, first in, last to leave, you know.
Well, but you said about half an hour ago that the real winners are the ones who come in early and stay late.
And the more kind side of me says not everybody's driven. Not everybody has got unlimited energy. People have family responsibilities. They're taking care of an aging parent. And it's got to be dispiriting in a way to tell people that the only way to succeed in this truly jobless recovery in this tough economy is to work harder, faster, more, get learning. Now your talent is not enough. It's the more kind side of me says that this is too tough. Do you think that if we were talking to our daughter Amy and she was just starting out at age 17 or 18 or in her 20s, which is what this article is written for, do you think this guy is being too tough or do you think he's right?
I think you are a standout if you work harder, yes. And I think that is noticed by your boss, yes. And I do think that's a good way to get ahead. Having said that, that doesn't mean that you're never going to get ahead because you prefer to have work-life balance.
Let me go to some more. These are some of these 20. These are 20 things that 20-year-olds don't get. Written by one of the quote top 20 people under 20 in their 20s, and that has gone viral. Over 3 million views in the few weeks that it's been out. Don't wait to be told what to do. You can't have a sense of entitlement without a sense of responsibility. You'll never get ahead by waiting for somebody to tell you what to do. Saying, no one asked me to do this, is a guaranteed recipe for failure. Err on the side of doing too much, not too little.
Agreed.
Take responsibility for your mistakes. You should be relatively humble when you're early in your career, but not defensive about your errors or in judgment or execution. Stop trying to justify your F-ups. You're only going to grow by embracing the lessons learned from your mistakes and committing to learn from those experiences. This is seeming like plain old common sense. This next one I like, though. You should be getting your butt kicked. Meryl Streep in The Devil Wears Prada would be the most valuable boss you could possibly have. This is the most impressionable, malleable, informative stage of your career. Working for somebody that demands excellence and top productivity will build the most solid foundation for your ongoing professional success. Do you think that if we had, if Amy was first starting out, our daughter, would you want her to have a Meryl Streep as a boss?
No.
Why not?
Because Meryl Streep was beyond someone who demanded excellence. She was, am I allowed to say the B word?
Yeah.
She was a bitch. And all of this, you didn't get the right coffee for me, and I demand to have my coffee and my breakfast on my desk. That is not part of the job description, and no, I would tell her not to work for somebody who treated her like that.
Point taken. I agree with you. Next one. A new job a year isn't a good thing. One-year stints don't tell me you're so talented you keep outgrowing your company. It tells me you don't have the discipline to see your own learning curve through to completion. It takes about 2 to 3 years to master any new critical skill. Give yourself that much time before you jump ship. Otherwise, your resume reads like a series of job hopping.
I think that's an old-fashioned approach. I would have said that 15 years ago, but I think in today's world, people do job hop frequently and move up quickly.
I'm agnostic on, we're not saying 20 years, but he says 2 to 3 years. Next one. People matter more than perks. This is great.
Well, I'm sorry. Let me go back to that for 1 second.
Yeah, yeah.
That's that whole thing. When opportunity knocks, run through the door. Mm. You've been at the job 1 year and someone has noticed that you're good and they're asking you to apply for a better job. Go. Do it. Take it.
Point taken. We have time for one more. There's much more, but for now, people matter more than perks. It's so trendy to pick the company that offers the most flex time, unlimited meals, company massages, game rooms, and team outings. Those may matter, but not as much as the character of your founders and managers. Great leaders will mentor you and be a loyal source of employment long after you've left. Focus on the folks you're going to work for, and your commitment to them will pay off much more than those fluffy perks. Agree? Disagree?
It depends who's organizing the perks.
What?
If your boss, if this is just a collegial thing that they want you to do all those fluffy things, but sometimes that's coming from the top. They're trying to create an office culture.
But the point is that it's the people that are supervising you that matter, not those little fluffy things, really.
Yeah, but if you're not getting along with your colleagues, it may not matter that your work is good because they can gang up on you.
Well, but I like to think that what really counts is the quality of the leadership that's going to be more likely to teach you stuff, mentor you, make sure you grow, whether or not they have a spirit day where they're may having ice cream social. Anyway,
hey, don't be making fun of those ice cream socials.
Yeah, I know you. Those listeners who don't know, my wife is the superintendent of schools, and she has periodic ice cream socials, which do indeed build rapport. And thank you, Barbara Nemco, for building the rapport as well as providing substance on this show. Thanks very much for staying on the whole hour. I didn't think we were going to do that, but we do what I think serves our listeners the best. So thanks, Barbara.
You're welcome.
Okay, and my thanks to my board operator, Debbie Kennedy, and, of course, to all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers, and I'll talk with Paul Falcone. He is a former senior HR guy at Nickelodeon, at Paramount, and he's the author of a great book called 101 Tough Conversations to Have with Employees. Very interesting book. Until next Sunday, for Barbara Nemco, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us. Growth among those who don't.
Marty Nemco's 2,000 articles are free on his website. From there, you also can email him if you'd like coaching on your career or to comment on this program. His site, martynemco.com, that's MartyNemko.com. You can join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemco here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.